Hi, John Rumpler. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Bill. It's great to be here.
John Rumpler is Clean Water. I'm director and senior attorney for Environmental America, an organization dedicated to protecting clean air, clean water, and promoting clean energy with a lot of supporters across all 50 U.S. states. John has directed numerous campaigns to protect our rivers, lakes, streams, and drinking water. He's co-authored several research reports, including Get the Lead Out, Fracking by the Numbers, and Corporate Agribusiness and the Fouling America's Waterways. He's been doing battle on the chemical and substance front to clean our waters and air and soils since 1985 when he was in the university, and along the way he got a law degree. John Rumpler is one of those heroes of modern life, one hesitates to say civilization, who are trying to stop the horde of substances and chemicals that are showing up in increasing numbers in water, soils, air, food, mother's milk, the snow in our highest, most remote mountains. And those heroes are in constant battle with the companies and the scientists and the venture capital funds and the hobbyists, who all are searching to make a buck by creating and selling, of course, some substances with some purported utility for somebody. And they're also in battle with public officials, some who went through the revolving door between company and government, or public officials who get nice campaign contributions from Dow or DuPont or Monsanto et al. And more and more. And also public officials whose popularity depends on keeping their local chemical or drug companies thriving and hiring. So, John, you're like a boxer who goes in the ring every day with heavyweight opponents and often doesn't win, and the opponents keep coming.
I guess I have a couple of bruises to show it, but also, some important victories along the way that give us all hope that we can move forward and have safe drinking water and clean rivers and lakes and streams for all of us across America.
And maybe across the world, too, because the stuff that is poured into the water there finally comes to us, doesn't it?
Sure.
Not in the same concentrations, but more and more every year. John, first, give us a list of the many chemicals and substances that you've tried to stop or control in your 40 years of efforts.
Well, there's a wide range. Bill, as we know, there are something on the order of 80,000 different chemical substances that are registered for commercial use on the market, and the vast number of those chemicals have never been proven safe. Historically, the standard has been that these chemicals are proven, they're presumed innocent until proven guilty, which is exactly the opposite of what precaution and a health-based policy would have for us. But some examples would include the non-stick and non-stain class of chemicals that we've known as far back as maybe some of us had Teflon pans. This class of chemicals known as perfluorinated compounds is increasingly linked to a wide range of health effects on people as well as wildlife. So that's probably one of the most, dangerous emerging compounds. There's the whole slew of chemicals that are used in fracking fluid, as well as the naturally occurring, sometimes radioactive substances that come up in fracking wastewater. And then some of the pollutants that we deal with in our waterways and our drinking water are not so complicated. Manure from huge factory farms, whether it's dairy or beef or pork, sewage overflows that sometimes contaminate our beaches with fecal bacteria, or lead that we managed to somehow put into our drinking water delivery systems over decades, and now we're struggling to get the lead out, as we learn that even low levels of lead impact the health of our children.
Yeah, talk about lead for a second. It seems to me that it's not only finding out how toxic it is and then getting it banned in some ways and regulated. It's also getting people to enforce it, because lead is so central, in fact, in plumbing systems and in many other things. They got it out of gasoline. You're having some of your victories are now that schools are testing their water systems and finding very high levels of lead, and then, of course, distilled water in plastic bottles. Who knows how safe they are over time. The enforcement is also extremely difficult. Seems to me you have to keep fighting on every front just to get people even to test for lead.
Right. In our view, the reason why we called our campaign Get the Lead Out is not only to convey the urgency that expression has, but also that literally that is the solution. It is to remove the lead pipes, the lead plumbing, the old faucets and fountains that contain lead. That is the way to ensure that we have safe drinking water in our homes, in our schools, in our child care centers, where our youngest and most vulnerable children are.
Yeah, are you also getting lead out of pellets, the munitions that hunters use to get birds and the rest of it? It seems to me that battle is just constant and going on.
That is not an issue that I have looked into. I have heard others raise that concern, but not something we're working on at this present time. Just that the place where we're focused is lead that is right in contact with our drinking water just moments before we fill our cups at the kitchen sink or a child takes a drink from the water fountain. There, the connection and the contamination is not speculative. It's well documented by thousands and thousands of tests that have been done at schools, that have been done from tap water and so forth. So that's why we're focused there, because we know the evidence is quite clear that we need to get the lead out.
Bill Resnick here at KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to John Rumpler, a Clean Water Program Director, Senior Attorney for Environment America. He's one of those beleaguered warriors trying to stop, at least control, the barrage of chemicals entering the water and soils and food and mother's milk and our bodies, of course. John, beginning of the interview, you noted the 80,000 chemicals that are being sold and used in the United States, and there may be some chemicals that even escape that. You're going at them one by one. It's got to be very frustrating because, in some ways, how do you reach those other chemicals that haven't been tested? You pointed out the assumption is somehow that they're innocent until proven guilty. It really should be exactly the opposite. But in any event, you're doing it one by one, and some of the worst offenders you've dealt with, pretty successfully, some of them, like lead, is being reduced. Asbestos is under control, at least, and it's being removed from lots of places, although not the homes of poor children. That would be expensive to landlords. But then there's the indirection effects. It's not just those 80,000 chemicals. It's that the pesticides and flame retardants and drugs and just the numerous chemicals that are being used, these microbeads that are now in all of our bodies and piling up that they use in toothpastes and other stuff, although that's been banned apparently. And what about the interaction effects? How do you deal with that question even?
Right. Well, I think scientists are still trying to sort that out. But increasingly what the evidence is showing is that these chemicals can have profound impacts on human health, even at very low levels. And when we look at, you know, maybe one set of chemicals that affects the endocrine system, another set of chemicals that weakens our immune system, a third set of chemicals that perhaps impact the reproductive system or neurological toxins that affect our brains, the way that our kids learn and behave and grow. You know, you look at all of these chemicals that are coming into our bodies, and there's no doubt that they're having an effect that where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
What to do about it, though, is the question. This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole on KABU Radio. I'm talking to John Rumpler, the Water Program Director and Senior Attorney for Environment America. He's been involved for 40 years, and We've been talking about vast number of chemicals that are part of our environment that we breathe and imbibe and have to live with. We've been talking about great number of them that are considered innocent until proven guilty, and nobody is spending money on doing the testing. There is some, of course, but it's minuscule in comparison to the number of chemicals that should be looked at. John, how are us greater apes going to survive this sort of onslaught of chemicals? How do you see this in the long run? What has to be done, and how on earth can we stop the people who want to make money on these chemicals from just continuing their operations?
Well, Bill, I think, you know, earlier you were asking about, you know, the approach of taking on these chemicals one by one. And I think there, you know, there are times when we need to do that, where there's a particular chemical that is an urgent public health threat and grabs the public's attention, and therefore we can get policymakers to act on that specific chemical. But I also think there are more comprehensive approaches that we can use. So, for example, these perfluorinated compounds that I was talking about, which many people, one of those compounds, for example, was used in Teflon, and, you know, people know them widely for non-stain and non-stick uses and so forth. We're now realizing the science tells us we have to address those as a class. There are something on the order of 4,500 different varieties of these chemicals, and we are pleading with state and federal decision makers to say, when you place a limit of how much of this stuff should be in our drinking water, it should be a cumulative health protective limit. Some scientists are saying it should be no greater than one part per trillion of all of these chemicals combined. So that's one way holistically to address these problems. Another is to look at operations, industrial activities that pose a wide range of toxic threats. So I was mentioning fracking. First of all, we need to be moving our nation to 100% clean, renewable energy to save the planet to begin with. But in addition to that, fracking, aka hydraulic fracturing, involves all kinds of multiple toxic effects, whether it is toxic air pollution at the gas site, toxic chemicals in the fracking fluid, radioactive materials that come up with the fracking wastewater. So these are multiple complex threats to our health. And if we can do away with this dirty drilling altogether, then we can address all of those problems together. So I think those are just two examples of where we can take a more comprehensive approach rather than just trying to fight, you know, 80,000 different chemical fights one by one.
That's right. Of course, that then leads to the problem of what about the Chinese, the Indians, the Europeans, the various other industrialized nations. But I suppose if the U.S. really began doing things, especially now on the energy front and the fossil fuel burning, it could have a major effect, particularly if the resources were made available to some of the poorer countries for some way of assisting them in saving their rainforests and all of the rest of the things that have to go on. This country is, we're in the belly of the beast.
I would say there are two ways that we can help on a global scale, or maybe even three. One is, remember that the American consumer is the driver of global demand and global manufacturing processes. If American consumers say, we don't want any more fabrics, we don't want any more carpets or upholstery or what have you with these toxic perfluorinated compounds, it's not worth risking cancer and contaminating our drinking water to have a nonstick pan when there are better alternatives available. You know, if the American consumer starts saying that, manufacturers around the world that provide consumer goods to the American marketplace are going to have to respond. The second thing, as you point out, is the lending of technology. I mean, we already know that there are places in the developing world that sort of leapfrogged over landlines and went right to cell phones, right? So they don't have to make all the same mistakes that we made. The great thing about solar energy, for example, is it can be so decentralized. With rooftop solar and small-scale or community solar panels. So this can be adopted at a small scale in local communities and reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, just as another example. And then the third thing is that, of course, our nation is home to many of the largest corporations in the world, and we can use our power here in the United States, regulatory power, consumer power, the power of investors, to shape the sustainable business practices of those operations and move in a way that is protecting our health as well as the bottom lines of those companies.
John Rempler, that's a great way to end on an optimistic note. Thanks so much for talking to us. I mean, what we all agree on is going to take great national movements before those changes can be made. I hope that we succeed in time before climate change becomes irreversible and we go through a long period of global roasting that maybe end human life. John, sometime we can talk about what does it mean to build that kind of movement. I think it's possible, actually, around a kind of a Green New Deal politics. Why don't you get the last word, John?
Sure. On that subject of building the movement, you know, I just want to note that for your listeners that our state affiliate is Environment Oregon. And we could not do this work without the support of our thousands of citizen members right there in Oregon. So I just want to say thanks to all of the folks that have participated in our campaigns, given us the support to be able to make the progress that we're making today.
John Rempler, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill.
Right. So long.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees.